Good afternoon, everyone. This is Representative Mahmoud Nur. I welcome you again to the Committee on Workforce and Business Development Finance to order. And with that, I just wanted to mention that this remote hearing is being conducted pursuant to the Rule 10.01 and can be viewed online at the House webcast. With that, I just wanted to ask the legislative assistant for the committee to take the role.
Nor.
Present.
Jay Zong.
Present.
Hamilton.
Present.
Baker. Baker. Dabney.
Present.
Frankie.
Present.
Greenman.
Present.
Haley. Haley. Juergens.
Present.
Cagle.
Present.
Patiza Watoon.
Here.
Olson.
Present.
Tujong.
Present.
Baker. Baker. Haley. Haley. Chair, we have quorum.
Thank you, Jason Chavez. There's a quorum present. I would like to entertain a motion to approve the minutes for January 25th.
So move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jay Zhong moves the approval for the minutes for January 25th. Any discussions? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motions for January 25th have been adopted. So members, today we do have a conversation on something that we all are aware of. We passed legislation declaring racism as a public health crisis during last year. And over the course of this summer and also this fall, there have been conversation on this subject. I know for many of us, sometimes it's difficult to talk about this topic because we talk about structural racism, we talk about racism in general. This is not to say someone is a racist. This is not about us versus them. This is not about taking resources from one group and giving it to the other. Members, it's a way of us to keep an open mind and think about our neighbors. Think about individuals who have been left out for a long, long time and figuring out how we can be fair, how we can be just, how we can be more equitable, and understanding from that equity lens of what we need to do. We all know that COVID-19 pandemic has disproportionately impacted the BIPOC community. We know that the various structural, long-term persistent that exist in our system, but we also know there are other societal impacts that have contributed to this crisis that we're dealing with. Today we'll have some conversation and we're glad to have one of our members who has served on the House Select Committee, which you have received the final recommendation that was sent to the legislature. Chair Moran and Co-Chair Ruth Richardson and also Vice Chair Lisa Demuth have put forward a very strong recommendation alongside with the members who serve. So I wanted to start the conversation by inviting our own member here, who was a member, Representative Cagle. If you can give us a little bit of a briefing in relation to the Select Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I was appointed to the Select Committee on Racial Justice. And over the interim, we had six meetings for this committee. And I'm just going to give a really brief overview of what those six meetings encompassed. But I thought it was really important. Our first meeting, we talked about the definition of racism. And so according to the Public Health Association, racism is defined as a system of structuring opportunity and assigning value based on the social interpretation of how one looks. And we call that race. And that it unfairly disadvantages some individuals and communities and unfairly advantages other individuals and communities and saps strength from the society as a whole and wastes human resources. And so as Chair Nora was saying, you know, racism is a system. It's not an individual character flaw or personal moral failing. It's a system of power that structures opportunity and assigns value based on a so-called race, the social interpretation of how we look. And one thing that I've found very helpful just in my kind of personal journey through this is this quote about anti-racism from author Ibram Kendi. And it's an anti-racist world can become real if we focus on power instead of people, if we focus on changing policy instead of groups of people. And it is possible to overcome if we, overcome our cynicism about the permanence of racism. So I find that super helpful when thinking about this conversation, that we're not talking about people or their individual feelings, but we're talking about the system as a whole. And so the six meetings that we had, our first meeting was what we had that definition of what is racism. And then we had a really good presentation about the maternal child health mortality and morbidity. And Black and Indigenous infants in Minnesota are twice as likely to die before their first birthdays than white infants. And nationally, U.S.-born Black women have the worst birth outcomes of any racial group. So even when controlling for household status, education, general health, income, insurance status, housing, stark disparities still remain. U.S.-born Black women in Minnesota are nearly three times more likely to die during pregnancy or within 1 year postpartum than white women. And Indigenous mothers are nearly eight times more likely to die in this period than white women. And we know that approximately 60% of these deaths are preventable. So the fact that these deaths are preventable highlights an important question. If these deaths are preventable, why are Black and Indigenous women dying at a higher rate? Our second meeting was about adverse childhood experiences and racism. And I think, you know, that's something that we're becoming much more familiar with, how these childhood experiences not only can carry through generations. And that kind of led to our historical trauma. We took a deep dive into the history of Indigenous people in Minnesota, and as also the historical trauma of African Americans in Minnesota. And this was something that kind of hit home with me because over the Christmas holiday, I was able to go and visit my grandmother, and she has all these family tree, you know, books and histories that I'm sure a lot of families have. And there was a page about one of my distant relatives participating in the mass hanging of the Indigenous people of Minnesota down in Mankato. And so this is something that, you know, is throughout our history and we have to recognize. Meeting four, I think, was very powerful. We had the public in to testify on the impacts of racism in Minnesota. And then in meeting five, we took a big portion of time to watch the Jim Crow of the North as it relates to the economic crisis in Minnesota, and specifically about redlining and how, you know, just buying a house in Minnesota has been something that was challenging. And then I'm super excited that we have Dr. Corey here to present. And then the sixth meeting, we went over the report and adopted the final recommendations to the legislature. And so this, you know, thinking about this committee, and I'm sure Dr. Corey will cover this because I'm pretty sure I pulled this from his presentation, but and there was also a report that Citi had done as well, talking about the economic costs of racism. And so the U.S. economy lost $16 trillion due to racism. 6.1 million jobs were not generated over the past 20 years because of racism. And BIPOC communities in Minnesota have lost an estimated $287 billion. And so, you know, really when thinking about the economic impacts of racism and how it applies to this committee, this is really where my head went when seeing these. And it's it was a really, I was so honored and proud to be part of that committee. And I just thank you for the opportunity to be able to present a little bit about it.
Thank you so much, Representative Cagle, for sharing and also serving on the select committee. We appreciate your input. Members, you've all received the final release from the House Select Committee. If you have a chance, I will ask you to watch the 6 sessions if you have time, but also read because there's so much that we can do together. If we put the time and effort to understand the deep-rooted structural racism that exists in our society, and for that, I think for this committee, as part of the initial presentation in Ways and Means, we have to ask ourselves, what are we presenting to the committee? And I will ask everyone to always ask that question. How will this impact other communities, especially the BIPOC community? You'll have to answer the question on equity so that you know exactly how this will be impacting the communities that we represent. If it doesn't, you have to state the same. So this will become a standard for us to work together to understand different communities that we represent. I would like to bring our first presenter, and I would like to ask members to wait until the end of the presentation so you can ask questions. Please take down all your questions and raise your hand. I will call you and you can ask any questions, and you may find the answer through the presentation. So members, as usual, wait until the presentation is completed by the presenter. With that, I want to introduce Dr. Bruce Curry, who is well known in this field and has been doing a lot of research and documentation throughout his career on this subject. Dr. Bruce, please welcome to the committee and start your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, members of the committee, for having me here today. It's an honor to be here to share some of my insights and findings, and I'll also take it on myself to keep track of time, and so that we have enough time for questions and as we move towards the end of the presentation. I want to commend Chairs Moran and Richardson and the committee, the House Select Committee on Racism, Racial Justice, that produced a groundbreaking report on this and shows a national leadership on this area of great importance. Most people in Minnesota will agree that racism exists and racial structures exist. And what this committee has done is to help develop some shared understanding about that experience, about what do we mean by things and what are the consequences. And so that is the framework in which my presentation begins, because what I want to do is to share some insights at the end of this spectrum of what's the ultimate economic cost of this system of racism that the committee talks about. And so for the most part, I'm going to be using some very simple census data. And analysis of census data. I will be using a little bit more sophisticated model to show how what we do in investments for racial equity will benefit all of Minnesotans. And I also want to be I realize that we are in a tight budget situation. And so I'm offering some recommendations and policies that for the most part do not require major investments, but can leverage major investments in this very timely moment. My academic and professional credentials are in the slides I forwarded. My apologies. I added some new slides and because I constantly work on my ideas. And so before the committee, I sent forward some more recent additions to the presentation. So I'll begin sharing my screen now. And the major areas that I'm going to be covering today is on the economic representation of BIPOC assets by legislative districts, the economic cost of racism, and some implication for business workforce and real estate development. You see, another context of both this committee and the legislature is that about in 2010, when the redistricting committee process was going on and the judicial panel welcomed public testimony, a group of us, a multi-ethnic nonpartisan group, went before the committee and showed them a map of BIPOC assets across legislative districts and posed the question to the judicial committee, how would you make sure that these economic, political, and other interests are adequately representative in the districts that you drew up? And so we also had offered them a model that we developed to show them what we could achieve using the simple principles of redistricting. So today, when I look at income, which is basically population times income of the BIPOC communities by districts, I find that about 125 legislative districts have economic assets of 100 million or more in their districts, constituents that need political and economic representation of their districts. And so this would cover about 85% of Senate seats and 51% of House seats. And for complete list, it's there are links on that slide. And this committee itself, when I add up the economic interest, there's a 2.56 billion of economic interest reflected in each of your districts. So how could we be good stewards of these economic assets and grow these economic assets because it is needed, the need of the hour? And the context that the report talks about was this disparity between a very flourishing economy and huge disparities, especially for Black and Indigenous Minnesotans. The committee talked about these patterns of discrimination in housing, in these redlining maps that were a fundamental source of depletion of equity and wealth building in the BIPOC communities across Minnesota and documented in these maps. And in other areas like education and business, there are various channels that where these policies ultimately takes its toll, or environment takes its tolls on these outcomes. And in my research in 1987, I basically illustrated that the emperor has no clothes, because I looked at what is the impact of economic policies ultimately on child survival and development of children in poverty. And so it was very complex mechanisms that the report documents that ultimately, so there are consequences of our actions or inactions. And so the value and the assets that the BIPOC communities bring are not only in the metro area, they play a very important role in the workforce all across Minnesota, as documented in these deed reports on both unemployment and employment and labor force in central Minnesota, northeast Minnesota, northwest Minnesota, southeast Minnesota, southwest Minnesota, and the Twin Cities area. And so they give us an idea of how we can tap these resources and labor force and talent and skills across Minnesota. Also, there have been reports, and I was the chair appointed by Governor Ventura in 2000 to statewide hearings and collection of data and analysis on the Governor's Working Group on Minority Business Development. And we produced that report, which has some very good recommendations of growing BIPOC businesses. And so there are other reports over years like the Equity Blueprint and the Twin Cities Economics Plan and others that repeat many of these similar kinds of recommendations. And unfortunately, a lot of these recommendations are on the table and have not fully gone into policies. So it is not surprising when we look at racial disparities as documented by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Office of Higher Education and Census, to see that there are gaps in income. Blacks earn 77 cents on the dollar compared to whites, Native Americans 68 cents. There is a huge 21% gap in education, in six-year graduation rates, the 53% gap in home ownership aid rates. And if you look at the business that this committee looks at a lot, the typical size of a BIPOC business is around 165,000 compared to about 1.4 million in terms of businesses at large. You might hear me say Alana sometimes when I talk about minority communities. It's my way of focusing on African, Latino, Asian, Native American communities. BIPOC is a more popular word, so I use that frame to also talk about this matter. So when I sum all these different gaps in income and housing and business development, and these are very narrow summation. I haven't gone into the multitude of areas that racism impacts. But when I look at these economic assets, there could be at least a $287 billion cost in terms of equity and wealth lost to these communities, and also lost to the state of Minnesota. If Minnesota had this in the economy, we would have been growing, our GDP would have been growing very rapidly. And this also implies that we were losing around $2 billion in taxes because of this income. So in the handout, I kind of break down the where this $287 billion occurs in the loss in income. If you look at lifetime earnings, so what would a typical person earn if they had a bachelor's degree, if they had a associate degree, if they had just a high school or less than high school, and how does it compare to the state's average? And so that's how you get this gap on lifetime earnings. What would happen if BIPOC businesses were of the same size as every other business in Minnesota? What would happen if the BIPOC community had the same home ownership rates like the rest of Minnesota? And summing all of that, I come across, I estimate this asset. And I mean, the value of the cost. And I want to point out that it's in the billions. It's a significant impact that has been borne by these BIPOC communities. And it also provides an opportunity of what we might do in the future. So the question that is posed before us is, how could we leverage these BIPOC assets to build the Minnesota economy? I like the framing of the matter that has been provided by Speaker Hortman and Chair Moran and others, that when we look at racial inclusion strategy, you look at like butter in the batter. And you know, when you bake, what butter does to not only the batter, but also to the final product. It makes a beautiful cake, right? And so focusing on investments and focusing on the BIPOC community wealth creation, we are going to build the whole of Minnesota at the same time address some of these historic costs. So the first step to on this journey is to acknowledge that this community brings and represents $1.4 trillion in assets. And as a point of comparison, the economy, the GDP of Mexico is about $1.2 trillion. So that's the magnitude of what and the potential of what the BIPOC communities can mean to Minnesota. And it's very important to acknowledge this value in our engagement, because we all know that one of the fundamental building blocks of oppression and racism and all other forms of oppression is the denial of value of the person. Because when you deny their value, you can exploit them. But when you acknowledge the value and treat them as assets, you're going to have healing and unleashes powerful energies to build Minnesota. And again, how is this $1.4 trillion broken down? It's in the income that people have. It's on their businesses. It's on their lifetime earnings. And we have two big pools of current potential and future potential. There are about 500,000 workers, essential workers, high-tech workers. And then we have about 500,000 people, human capital, waiting to be formed. That is people in our school and university systems. And if all of them have a bachelor's degree, that would represent about a $1.5 trillion of lifetime earnings for Minnesota that they can tap on, and the impacts for taxations and others. And so they bring a lot to the table. And one of the challenges that we find in our BIPOC communities are these big gaps, the gaps in capital, the gaps in capacity, the gaps in collaborating between various different groups and with the policy work, and then the policy gap of bringing in policies that can be effective. And so the House Select Committee on Racial Justice proposed $1 billion economic development fund because the magnitude of the challenge is huge and you have to have a response that way. And I want to illustrate different ways that we can get to 1 billion, which need not necessarily be 1 billion of new investment, but ways in which we can leverage existing resources and ways in which we can change policy that would have major economic impacts. So why would we need $1 billion economic development fund? Well, we need to have a core wealth-building infrastructure in every community, every BIPOC community. They should access a business incubator, maker spaces, job boards, land trusts, an equity fund for capital, home housing. They should have technical community-based organizations that can help in their wealth creation activities. And all of this would require investments. At the same time, it's very timely because the nation is realizing the importance of addressing the issue of racial disparity. And there is a lot of possible funding that's going to come from multiple sources. And if the state shows the leadership and offers the leverage, the state can capture these resources. So a way in which you could leverage a smaller amount of money to gain economic maximum impact would be, say, loan guarantees. So for a loan guarantee of $100 million, you can leverage maybe close to $1 billion, because when you enter a deal, there's risk sharing, and banks and other entities would like to come into the picture, but they would like to have some kind of a backup. And an example would be the loan guarantee that BEAD has for the PPP program that a president of Great Bank shared with me how effective it was, because it allowed the banks to go out and give these loans to small, help these small business get access to these loans. And there's not, the loan loss ratios on this are very low, because the banks and others do their due diligence. So you're taking an asset of the state and you're just leveraging it to yield, to bring other players in the table. And for example, if you were to do a project, you would have these loan guarantees, or you would have TIF districts, and these could be complemented with fundings from banks, foundations coming in, ethnic-based, community-based organizations that are actually managing these projects so that wealth percolates to the communities and there's ownership and empowerment that occurs. So it's a very effective strategy that costs no money. And if the legislature is in the mood for taxation, the redlining and the depletion of real estate assets sets the base of a tax that could fund the repayments of the bond. The House Select Committee also recommended things that cost no money, and that is enforcing Chapter 16C and dedicating 15% of all public contracting to BIPOC, because the statute says 25% of all contracting should go to small business. And establishing these 32% workforce goals, streamlining the bidding process, redesigning proposals, breaking down processes and artificial barriers, unbundling large projects, and so on, and then enforcing a very effective tool that we have, Section 3 of HUD. And why it's important, because from the time I was looking at this statistics in 2000 as chair of the Governor's Working Group on Minority Business Development, and today, the percentage of total contracts going to the BIPOC communities has hovered around 1%, 2%, and that is for the past 20 years. So this is the time of leadership. This is the time that we could make a big difference. And when we do something, we have to make sure it's not a one-time kind of an investment, but we've got to make sure that these businesses grow by helping them develop mentoring relationship, helping them with capacity and setting goals so that when we look back, for instance, in this database of certified businesses in the CERT database, I looked there about 600 businesses. If that's your baseline, 5 years from now with contracts, we want to see how have those businesses grown, what kind of jobs have they created, what kind of revenue are they bringing to the state as well as their own growth. So investing in the BIPOC communities are going to help everybody. And I want to illustrate how and this word, this phrase or this vision of the African-American community, the lift as we climb, fits in how investment in our BIPOC communities can actually cause all of Minnesotans to improve. So I use a model called the implant model, which shows the intersectionality of our investment decision. So I pose this question to the model, since BIPOC businesses are about 10% of all businesses, but only have 1% of all sales, what would it imply if they began to have 10% of sales in different sectors in which they were located? So that was my initial run. And the model revealed that if they were to grow this way, total output in the state would grow by $111 billion. And if you notice, there are so many different sectors that will be benefiting from this growth in business. It would create 500,000 jobs for, it would support 500,000 jobs for all Minnesotans and would cost an estimated $13 billion in tax increase. So it could be a win-win situation. I looked at some scenarios, for instance, in the bonding bill that went, that was last year awarded to the Hmong American Farmers Association. Beyond the bonding bill, that was a strategy to build the next generation of farmers, Hmong farmers, Latino farmers, African farmers, Black farmers, Native American farmers. And by this small project in Dakota County could leverage growth and investment and the tax base in Dakota County. I did another simulation on the Red Lake Nation and showed how that investment of $5.5 million in the Red Lake Nation project would generate $14 million an estimated growth in output and support close to 150 jobs and generate about $2.51 million in federal, state, and local taxes. So as you invest in the BIPOC communities, they're going to help all of Minnesota's improve and some of the recommendations we talked about earlier. I also want to share with you something that's been close to my heart and my work, where I've worked a lot on with others on how cultural assets can be leveraged as a strategy for economic development in low-income diverse neighborhoods. And if you go to down University Avenue, you have Little Africa and Little Mekong and Rondo. And these are cultural destinations that are not just a grocery store. To become a destination, they should offer cultural vibrancy such as food, music, art, murals, and so on. They should offer welcoming quality and safe experience. And it's a business, an investment in business and wealth creation. And in order to happen, most likely you need a partner, a community-based partner, a CDC, to help these businesses achieve this. And an example of this would be, this is a restaurant by the airport, Al Galgal, and you could see an event that featured artists, African artists, and Ethiopian coffee, and in a restaurant that has murals out there to encourage people to come and experience a different experience. And on Lake Street, you can see the multitude of these experiences offered. and the murals and the food, like here, the many different flavors of Mexico, Mexican ice cream. You don't have to go to Bangkok to achieve the vibrancy of Bangkok night market. We had it right here in our backyard in St. Paul. And Little Africa, we don't have to go to Africa to enjoy the music and the sounds of Africa. We had it right in our backyard let me just move it forward. Yes. I'm just going to forward it a bit so that I can move forward. Excuse me. I'll just forward that a minute and go back to the slide. Similarly, we have in the Africa, in the American Indian Cultural Corridor, that offers the experience of the indigenous people, an experience of Rondo and the Pullman Porters on University Avenue, and lately an example of how the power of this model. When these restaurants were closed, I organized the Taste of the World Tour, where people could go to each one of these locations and enjoy the food of Mexico, of Burma, of Thailand, of Cambodia, of Somalia, and capture the experience. And the power of this model was when I talked to one of the restaurant owners, he says, I've been getting all kinds of new customers I've never seen before. I'm so happy my market and my base has expanded. So while you think about investments, think about grant programs to invest in murals and art and entertainment to create these cultural destinations, capacity grants to the organizations that are helping them achieve these grants. And we have some tools already in place, 1% of art in public buildings and the legacy funding, there could be percentages of them dedicated to the ethnic artists so that they can facilitate these models to grow and expand in Minnesota. Finally, I want to talk about workforce and the importance of the hard hit BIPOC communities during COVID crisis, as Chair Noor mentioned. What the latest statistics of DEED are showing in this central area is that the challenge of prolonged unemployment and being separated from jobs being amplified in Black and indigenous communities in particular. And so what we need to do is some strategies I'm sorry about that, but again, when I click the link, it clicks to that event, but I'll keep talking. So we're accounting for strategies that would help these communities improve workforce, and two important strategies are I can't freeze out of the system, so I...
Dr. Corey, you're still with us.
Yeah, okay, so you can see my screen?
No, we cannot, so I know okay. The technical difficulties.
Okay, so I'll keep on because I'm just gonna wrap up anyway. So there two workforce strategies that you could think about. One is what the Federal Reserve Banks are calling opportunity occupations. Occupations that have certain similar skills that you could translate someone from a low-paying job of $15,000 a year to move them to a higher-level job. Very similar to career pathways, but different. But you would need those kinds of strategies to invest in bringing this hard-to-reach unemployment that is unemployed that is occurring across Minnesota. And finally, in conclusion, I want to add that there are multiple other strategies such as the leveraging of bank deposits in the state, leveraging the state investment portfolio, and other strategies that could help build in this pool of money and resources that could we could do things right now in investing in our communities. So I'll stop there for now and take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Curry. I just wanted to recognize two members who joined us during the presentation, Representative Haley and Becca, in attendance in this hearing today. I just wanted to give members an opportunity to ask questions. Otherwise, I've got several questions for Dr. Curry. So, Dr. Curry, I think you mentioned as part of your last part of the conversation about the lack of, banking and other institutions. Quite frankly, we haven't seen any major, economic boost when it comes to developing our own minority depository institutions. I know we do have a few CDFIs through the CDCs that you just covered. What is prohibiting the state of Minnesota to attract those kind of investors who want to see an economic development happening in the communities of BIPOC and low-income individuals?
Chair Noor, that's a very great question, and I think it's a timely question. Vice President Harris, while senator, was part of a group of people that were working with Senator Warner that proposed to Congress changing, empowering financial, these depository institutions to be owned by minority communities, BIPOC communities, changing the way Federal Reserve Bank operates. And so now that she's in the White House, we could see those kinds of changes possibly happening. So the question arises to Minnesota is, how could we be ready to take advantage of those changes? That's why we launched this Alana African Latino Asian Brain Trust, to get people with the concepts and the tools ready to take advantage for it. So for example, 2 days ago, there was a conversation with a person with in the equity world around developments in North Minneapolis. And he said, we're ready to bring equity capital into these projects. But we want to show, but can you bring together a team of state investments like these loan guarantees? Can you bring together banks that would be participating? Because we should take the village. You got to show that you got skin in the game too, and that it's not our investments only. So the state can offer this portfolio of tools. And so, for example, you have this 100 million loan guarantee pool. You have TIF districts. You have these other tools that you operate. And projects could apply for them where they package these deals together that make these things happen. And the moment you do that, as this banker told me, he says, we are willing to invest provided we know that the entities that we are working with have staying power, that we have risk sharing, and these things like loan guarantees work magic for them because they have be able. So it's a very timely, important question because there are millions, literally millions of dollars of foundation. Just think about the Bush Foundation locally announced that $100 million social impact fund. The state could say, hey, we leverage you and focus on these investments.
My follow-up, Dr. Curry, is for any economy to thrive, you need to have consumer spending. And the consumer spending is so significant when you've got new Americans, when you've got individuals who are moving up the ladder because they're gaining more income as they go through their career process. They buy homes. In fact, there's more than 16,000 BIPOC community members who are ready, mortgage ready, but they don't have the opportunity to buy those homes, which is holding back, quite frankly, our economy. They buy durable goods. How can we as a state incentivize the need for more consumer spending? Because we know they're in the lower brackets in the economy. Any resource they get will be invested back into the economy.
Chanur, yeah, I will also work on that economic model to show that particular impact that you're talking about of the 16,000 households. But the access to capital is this big block that's preventing this entrepreneurial energy to happen. I did a study on the, we did with the African immigrant communities, did a study on the economic contribution of African immigrants. We did over 500 surveys, which reached such a wide diversity of the African immigrant community. And from there, I estimated what were they spending. We asked them, where are you spending that money? They talked about the Targets and the Walmart. So they are spending at least $500,000, $1 billion. I can get you the exact numbers, just on mainstream stores. And then another significant chunk of money on the ethnic-based stores. Now, what would happen if you, a lot of these communities would say require alternative finance instruments. What if we offered some profit sharing and other kinds of investment pools? You're going to cause an economic engine being mobilized, not only in the Twin Cities, but in many towns and cities across Minnesota, where this new spending multiplier is going to happen, and they're going to be going to all these stores. And I have the list of names of all the stores that these people shopped at. So that's a good question. So again, going back to how could we assemble a portfolio of tools that can leverage the spending, and then many things don't cost money, such as the utilization of businesses and existing state funding, the utilization of workforce and existing funding.
Thank you so much, Dr. Curry. I know you can wait for a few more extra minutes just in case there are any questions, but I just wanted to say thank you for the work that you do for all of us, and I appreciate your insight and dedication to this matter. So with that, we do have the second presenter, Andrea Fustin. Please introduce yourself to the committee and welcome, and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to pull up my presentation. I am Andrea Furstam, Vice President of System Innovations with the Center for Economic Inclusion. And the Center for Economic Inclusion was established a little over 3 years ago by our founder, Tawana Black. And we have deep partnerships and focus on working with the public sector and with the private sector, through partnership with community, particularly BIPOC communities, all with the focus on advancing an inclusive economy. So as we do this, we really look at commitments with employers and with policymakers that are focused around co-creating anti-racist talent, procurement, investment, and policy strategies, much of what you've been talking about today. We look at shared power and transferring of power with BIPOC communities to achieve income and wealth equity. This is about growing the pie. It's about ensuring that access to capital, to business development, to home ownership, that wealth is intergenerational wealth. And then it's about establishing goals. So really looking at, we have some equity goals in the state, but really looking at what are those key drivers of an inclusive economy. And I'll speak more to that in a moment. And then how do we ensure that we have that North Star and that we're having that shared accountability by measuring against that and using that as a lens by which we make budget decisions, policy decisions, much like you referenced in terms of the equity impact note. So here is Metro data, but I think it's important to look at it. As we look at inclusive economic growth, this compares the MSP region and shows how we are lagging our peer Metro regions in most dimensions of inclusive economic growth. And then when we look at disparities, and much of this has been touched on, I'm just going to really reinforce a couple points here, that the state of Minnesota continues to be the second biggest, have the second biggest income inequality gap, and that the median Black family income in the Twin Cities area is just a little over $38,000 a year compared to their white counterparts, that's close to $84,500. So just another way of looking at that data that I think is extremely impactful. So we referenced the disproportionate impact of the dual pandemic. I want to just lift a couple of these data points here. That BIPOC individuals in the metro area constitute 23%, yet have made up 36.6% of UI claims, unemployment insurance claims. And then, of course, we've talked about this Black-white wage gap and the 20% increase in that gap in the last 20 years. And this last one I really want to make sure to lift up, which is that 41% of Black-owned businesses have been shut down by COVID-19 nationally, compared to just 17% of white-owned businesses nationally. So now let's shift and talk about the opportunity. And Dr. Corey did a wonderful job of really speaking to sort of the economic opportunity and imperative to this. I'll just go quickly through a couple of these points that really by closing the wealth gap, we'd see a 4.4 to 6% increase in U.S. GDP. And that as we look at employers' actions, I think this is particularly powerful that we've got two-thirds of leaders saying that they're creating an inclusive environment, and yet only a third of employees are believing it. And if we were able to move or close this perception gap by just 50%, we would see over $1 trillion in increased profit. Then if we look at this in terms of income parity, you can see here that if we had income parity, we'd have $31.8 billion in GDP or 1.6% annual growth. And then if we think about this in terms of BIPOC businesses, I think this is particularly powerful that they generate $5.2 billion in annual revenue. They're Minnesota's ninth largest employer. And then I think what is particularly powerful is that BIPOC businesses grew at 3.5 times the rate of all Minnesota businesses. And so if we're looking in terms of how we think about our economic recovery, this becomes a key lever in terms of intentional investment. The last piece here is it showing that BIPOC businesses, if there was parity there with whites, we'd see 87,000 more workers employed today. And we know that BIPOC businesses disproportionately hire BIPOC workers. And so this becomes not only an economic driver, but a job creation strategy. So now let's talk about the approach. So as we talk about solutions, sort of big picture here, solutions should be centered on BIPOC individuals, communities. Solutions must be data informed, and solutions must be market responsive. We know our demographics are changing, and we also know that our labor market is changing. And so as we think about solutions, it's important that we are designing policies, making investment decisions that respond to those changes. This piece is the indicators for an inclusive economy that we use, and this comes from the Rockefeller Foundation framework for inclusive economies. And a couple things I want to touch on here is that this is about elevating a focus on policies and practices that will accelerate regional economic growth through increased access to opportunity, upward mobility, and increased empowerment for BIPOC communities. And these are where we really look to as we look at goals of where we need to be. These become the key metrics and drivers of really driving the growth that we want to see. So next, I'm going to really just dig into the policy recommendations. And some of these you'll be very familiar with. Both Dr. Corey references these. Many of these are in the House report. But one I want to touch on first is the equity impact note that was put forward in 2016. Representative Moran spoke to this, Mr. Chair had spoke to this as well. This is, to me, is about institutionalizing what is being talked about now in terms of really how we use the note as a tool when looking at fiscal proposals. It provides a means of facilitating intentional focus on advancing racial equity and ensuring an inclusive economy best positioned for maximum growth by really looking at those budget proposals, legislative proposals within the context of that impact. I want to just note that the Center for Economic Inclusion and Voices for Racial Justice are really willing to work with MMB, legislators, and all state agencies on developing appropriate criteria so that the execution of an equity impact note or even that intention right now can be taken across each committee and by each chair. Now, the next one is really around establishing goals. I touched on this. This is about ensuring we have that North Star and that shared accountability and that we're using that in terms of looking at results and future decision-making. The bulletin items are things that we're lifting from the House report that we think really are high impact. It's not meant to be a comprehensive list, as there are a number of, I think, excellent recommendations in that report, but these are ones we want to lift as really ones that we want to bring particular attention to. And so I won't read through these. These are ones you're probably familiar with, but I wanted to just close with a few comments that these recommendations are not charity. These recommendations are critical to undoing racism built into our policies, practices, and systems. Further, as outlined in the slides that I touched on earlier, these investments will have significant economic impact on the entire state's economy as BIPOC workers increase their spending power and BIPOC-owned businesses increase the number of family-sustaining jobs in the market. So I'll end here and turn it back to you, Mr. Chair, for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fasten, for your presentation and insights into how to have an inclusive economy. Members, if you have any question, please feel free to ask. But this is more in line with what we're facing today in terms of establishing pathways for an inclusive economy whereby we invest where it's needed. I know, Ms. Fasten, you mentioned about the loan guarantees as one piece of the, the puzzle to solve the need that we have at this point. So how do we reach a process whereby we can be more targeted and be more specific to ensure that the resources that we have will impact significantly on the inequities that exist in the market and the economy?
Yeah, so this is something I'd be happy to have further conversation with, but I think this is and something that we could bring in our CEO to that conversation as well. But I think that particular recommendation is important because often what we hear from financial institutions is this sort of risk avoidance. And I think by that partnership between the public and private sector, we really begin to change the dynamics and we really begin to talk about that intention around where we need to be growing our economy, really looking at that intention and the longstanding wealth extraction that we've had. And then how do we then do that by not just so-called managing risk, but really by looking at this from an asset frame, but recognizing that there would need to be a designed, intentional approach to that.
Thank you. Ms. Fasten, how do we merge the private sector and the public sector and also the nonprofit? Sometimes it's not only the state that will solve the issues. How do we create more robust public-private nonprofit partnership to really tackle the major problem that we foresee in the economic outlook?
Yeah, so this is something the center is deeply committed to, and we are bringing public and private sector together in a trust. We're developing individual contractual relationships to really drive those shared goals. I think when we look at the legislature, certainly there's examples of legislation that are written to really drive that partnership. And I think it's also about building those relationships and convening those tables, task forces to really both develop and then drive those solutions.
Thank you so much. I look forward to that conversation to allow us to, think through the process, how we can reimagine our economy to be more successful, inclusive, and be able to really, this is a matter of generating more revenue for the state and for the cities and the counties and local government. So we need to be more strategic, be more precise, and to be able to provide those opportunities and possibilities. So thank you so much, Ms. Fasting, for your presentation. You can wait just in case of any questions that may come in the end. We've got 30 minutes. So the next presenter is Kaying Yang. Please introduce yourself and start the presentation.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Kaying Yang, and I am the Director of Programs and Partnerships for the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. I'm going to just share my screen for a minute here. We are a social justice network organization that brings over 4,000 Asian Minnesotan leaders from across sectors, ethnic groups, and generations together to harness our collective power to ensure Minnesota works well for everyone. I'm very honored to be here today because when we talk about equity solutions, Asian Americans are often excluded from this table. So I'm just very pleased and to be here and to talk a little bit about our community. And I think it's a perfect fit into this conversation because I want to focus very specific to the Asian American community here. My presentation today will include three parts. First, I will share a context about the Asian Minnesotan population. Secondly, I will talk specifically about what we know and have heard about how this community has been impacted by COVID-19. And lastly, I'll leave you with some recommendations. Asian Minnesotans, as you know, have a rich and complex histories with and experiences in Minnesota. Our population is diverse and represents over 40 different ethnic groups. Though our immigration paths vary greatly within the population, I want to contextualize the diversity because it will give you a deeper understanding of the important nuances at the intersections of race and ethnicity, immigration, gender, culture, and economics that must be considered as you move forward in recovery efforts for Minnesota's economy. Many Asian Indian Minnesotans immigrated here as highly skilled workers who are feeling a need in our economy and helping it grow in specialty areas such as technology, medicine, and the sciences. Southeast Asian Americans represent 60% of the Asian Minnesotan population and include ethnic minorities such as Hmong, Lao, Cambodian, Burmese, and Vietnamese. Many Southeast Asians came as political refugees in the 1970s and have entangled relationships with the United States. Karen, Minnesota from Burma are the largest recent Southeast Asian population to arrive in Minnesota. And Chinese Minnesotans include our first Asian families who came to Minnesota, but also a growing part of the newer skilled workforce needed by our companies here. And finally, Minnesota is home to our nation's largest Korean adoptee community. Together, the almost 300,000 Asian Minnesotans comprise 5% of the state's population and is the fastest growing group in our state and nation. We are one of the youngest populations with a median age of 29 overall, but are significantly younger within the Southeast Asian communities. So it's not a surprise that we make up the largest group of working aged adults at 26,000 people, according to the State Demographer's Office. As a whole, we pay over $900 million in taxes to this state annually. We make significant contributions to the Minnesota economy and community. And using Dr. Corey's data, there are over 16,000 Asian businesses with $4 billion in sales and 27,000 employees with an annual payroll of $700 million. These businesses can be found in low-income neighborhoods, as well as in the medical and high-tech field. Over 130,000 Asian American workers build Minnesota's economy in a wide range of occupations, ranging from manufacturing and food processing to doctors and scientists. And over 88,000 youth are in our school and university systems. All are the future workforce of Minnesota. But like every community, we also have challenges. Our members made most vulnerable are families and individuals with immigration and refugee statuses, women and children, low-income workers, families living in poverty, those with limited English proficiency and limited technology fluency in multi-generational households. Additionally, it goes without saying that the generalizations that Asians are universally successful and are perpetual foreigners has detrimentally excluded this population from many opportunities and efforts. Asian community experiences the widest income in the US, with those in the top 10% of the income distribution earning nearly 11 times more than those in the bottom 10%. For instance, Asian Indians have nearly 4 times as much household income as the Burmese community. Hmong and Laotian communities have both low median household incomes per capita income when compared to other groups. And in employment, aggregated data shows that across the board, overall state population, white population, Asian population, employment status is relatively same. Disaggregated data, however, shows us important nuances. For example, the unemployment rates are twice as high among those in Cambodian and Hmong communities compared to the general population. And the data about those not in the labor force may be explained by the population's median age. As shown in that previous slide, the Burmese population are the youngest among these 10 Asian subpopulations listed here, and Japanese are the oldest. So disaggregated data should be collected and used to better understand the complexity and lived experiences of different Asian Minnesotan communities. Since the COVID pandemic, nationally in the US, the unemployment rate between February 2020 and May 2020 among Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders rose from 2.2% to 13.3%, which is a larger gap than the overall unemployment rate. Unemployment is heavily concentrated among workers in low-paying jobs. Female workers are experiencing unemployment at a higher rate than their male counterparts. Workers who were not born in the United States are also experiencing unemployment at a higher rate than those US-born counterparts. And workers with less formal education are experiencing unemployment at a higher rate than the ones with bachelor's degree. I'm just sharing data that you may have already seen from MDH here, but COVID-19 brought to the forefront xenophobic and anti-Asian racism that further exacerbated the economic downturn for many. Asian Minnesotans felt unsafe to simply take care of themselves. Their businesses closed, and unemployment soared, as I just mentioned, in certain industries. And in addition, because of our community's larger representation in certain fields like meatpacking or healthcare, they had to work and were overexposed to the coronavirus. So for example, we represent 5% of the Minnesota state population, but we also make up 5% of all cases, COVID cases. 6% are hospitalized, 8% are in ICU, and have a 4% death rate. So particular segments of the community are now desperately facing health and financial insecurity. Asian Minnesotans are experiencing this crisis in a very unique and negative way. Like other minority groups, we face barriers to accessing health, education, and economic resources. But we have also been singled out as Chinese and are facing racism and xenophobia. This combination of challenges is putting our community at grave risk of negating all the positive progress that the community has made in Minnesota. As the pandemic continued, we convened our community and heard from micro and small businesses that economic relief programs are often not designed to be accessible to these businesses who need financial support and help the most to survive. These include minority-owned businesses and other companies that are traditionally disadvantaged in the lending market. The following story at the beginning of the pandemic illustrates the challenges faced by business owner Dana. She says, "I have been supporting myself financially since I was 17 years old. 4 years ago, I bought a house in Savage, Minnesota. But about three years ago, I decided to follow my passion and started my own business. I was doing well. Then the deadly virus arrived in Minnesota and I had to close my doors. I cried every day and I struggled to ask people for help. I felt like my independence and joy were taken away. I have been, I'm gonna go back a little bit, but let me finish her story. I cried every day and I struggled to ask people for help. I felt like my independence and joy were taken away. I have contacted all my financial institutions and where I have obligations asking for relief. They have been very slow in getting back to me. Fortunately, my student loan and building lease provided me 60 days of relief, but I feel lost because I don't know how I am going to be able to pay anything after 60 days. I'm scared to complete. The loan programs are complicated. I have started multiple applications, but I'm scared to complete them because I cannot afford the burden of any more debt. I call Deed and other programs because I need help, but they just tell me, I don't know how to help you specifically. They just advise me to keep looking at their website for updates. I'm gonna try to go back to my other slides for a minute here. Dana's story and concerns are like so many small and micro businesses owned by Asian entrepreneurs at this time. Business owners cannot risk taking on loans and few grants are available for businesses. Many are underbanked and have little capacity to apply for forgivable loans. By the time they hear about programs, they are often too late because bigger businesses with more capacity have tapped into the resources already. In addition, Asian Minnesotan businesses fear xenophobia and racist discrimination are stopping customers from patronizing their businesses. I'm gonna stop sharing for a little bit and try to go back to my slide, if you don't mind. I apologize for the delay. Can you see the slides?
Not yet, Miss Yan.
Okay, let me try one more time. Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, can you see it now?
Yes, we can see. Continue, okay. Miss Yan, please.
Okay. Between April 2020 and November 2020, we surveyed Asian Minnesotan small micro business owners to understand how the impact of COVID has had on their businesses, what their concerns are, and what kind of assistance they needed during and after the pandemic. Of the respondents you can see on the graph, 42% provide business and wellness services and supplies, 21% are in the restaurant and hospitality sector, and 47% generate less than $99,000 in revenues, 19% generate between $100,000 and $249,000. So you can see they're very small and micro. All respondents reported their business suffered negative financial impacts during the pandemic. 72% had either decreased revenue or no revenue at all, and 51% had to reduce their business hours and or temporarily close business. Due to their decrease in hours of revenue, 43% respondents reported they have been unable to pay bills for their businesses. Asian Minnesotan entrepreneurs face many barriers, as I said, when they try to access financial assistance. Our survey shows that community organizations were the primary source of support for receiving information and assistance about loans and grant programs. They indicated that even after they found the information about how to apply for financial assistance, they faced additional barriers by completing the applications. They indicated the application processes and forms required were often complex, cumbersome, and the rules were confusing. Applicants found the application process especially difficult if English was not their primary language. Many respondents said they need help in understanding government resources, complying with requirements for government resources, including technical assistance. We suspect that this is the first time many of these small businesses have had to request governmental assistance to their business and are unaware of how to navigate that process, unlike nonprofit organizations. Again, community-based organizations are key in bridging the communication between government and private programs and Asian Minnesotan small businesses. So we recommend that you engage and listen closely to underserved and underrepresented communities to ensure solutions are equitable. These communities are rarely asked about their needs and challenges. So most end up spending their time reacting to programs that have been passed rather than providing input on the design of policies and programs. For example, the short application periods have been especially challenging for communities who have limited English proficiency. Recently, we published a report entitled Redefining Wealth Through Communal and Cultural Assets. Our intention is to identify opportunities to better meet the needs and build on the assets of the community and develop systemic solutions that help Asian Minnesotans achieve intergenerational wealth. This report is unique in that it includes both disaggregated quantitative and qualitative data to elevate the nuanced lived experiences of Asian Minnesotans. A key highlight of the report is that when the current economic structures and institutions are unhelpful or inaccessible to Asian Minnesotans, they rely heavily on family, relatives, and community members for support. There is a need to build on communities' cultural assets and communal behaviors to recover and build back harder or better. Start by acknowledging and respecting the widespread collective resource sharing practices. When you think about policies and practices that can and should help and or should help these communities build financial wealth, identify and integrate these cultural values and assets into the financial practices and policies of formal economic institutions, structures, and systems. Minnesota is in a position to model to other states the equitable way of talking about Asian communities and opens up opportunities to model how to partner with communities to create systems that are reflective of the community's assets. Finally, during this time of crisis, our state must work harder to meet and support Asian, Black, Indigenous, and Latinx communities, following our 6 recommendations for your consideration. One, we recommend that you embed equitable practices in economic and wealth building legislation. Provide specific eligibility criteria that prioritizes historically underserved and underrepresented communities and make technical assistance available to them. 2, provide relief that prepares for recovery, not more debt. Provide grants for businesses that have smaller revenues and work with micro and small businesses to make sure they have the capacity to apply for those given loans. Invest in essential health safety plans. 4, support community-based organizations in the economic recovery. Provide a substantial long-term funding for community-based organizations, capacity, be strategic partners and effective cultural health building programs. 5 has been distributed and identify which communities are being left out. This information is not only inclusive, but informs policymaking decisions as well as practices and programs to support these populations. And design program frameworks and metrics from an individual. As my colleagues have said, this pandemic has shed light on structural inequities that are deeply embedded in our system and society. We urge you to listen to community members, advocacy organizations, and families, and to support policies that bring about deep systemic changes. We need your leadership to help ensure that every community has the economic resources to recover from the pandemic. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much, Ms. Yang, and I appreciate your input. You have highlighted many things that we need to take into consideration. You talked about the lack of dedicated technical support because some of these resources may be federal or state, but sometimes we tend to not prescribe how those technical assistance need to be supporting micro enterprises that you have talked about and some of the businesses. So I think we will have to think deep in terms of providing more dedicated technical assistance so that we can support businesses who have been impacted by COVID-19, but also to ensure that people are doing much better than before the pandemic. So those are challenges I think we all face. Members will entertain if there's anybody has a good question. I see Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's more of a statement. Dr. Yang, Dr. Corey, I really appreciate working with you in the past. Dr. Corey, I always appreciate you taking the time to educate me on the issues as well. We've had some time that we've spent together. I really, really appreciate that. Another thing that I'd like to comment on, Mr. Chairman, it's been very helpful for me, not only to visit with business owners and stuff in the district in which I represent, but it's also been very, very helpful and beneficial. Former Representative Karen Clark would extend an invite and I would accept and tour the district that she serves, meet with various individuals and what was important to them. And that's why I was happy to carry the bill on urban agriculture initiatives. And I had Senator Howe that invited me to his district. We visited some businesses over there as well. So I just want to say thank you to the members who extended that invite. And I'd also like to encourage individuals who do receive an invite to take them up on that as well. It's been very helpful. So again, thank you to the presenters. The information's been very beneficial. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much, Representative Hamilton. I think sometimes the data and the information that we get, I tell people that this is more even than what we've received in college and university. So we're getting more educated. Maybe we should get a degree out of all this knowledge that we're all gaining out of through legislative process. So it's more of factual data. It's more direct. It's more informative. And sometimes I think it helps us do better for our state. So I know we will have more conversation based on the bills that are going to be put forward to address some of the challenges that we've had today. So for next week, we will be discussing the budget recommendation that was put forward yesterday, and we'll have more conversation. And I'm hoping that you have a chance to read through the budget recommendation. This is a moment that we have to pay close attention to how we're going to be solving some of the challenges that we're facing. So for that, I don't know if anybody has got any statement before we end the meeting today.
Chair Noor, can I say make a comment, please?
Yes, proceed, Ms. Yang. And I see Representative Gagel next.
Yeah, and I turn off my camera because my daughter is in school right now, but I wanted to acknowledge Representative Hamilton. He was, I don't know if you remember Representative Hamilton, but you were the chief author of a bill that we passed in 2017 called the Nonprofit Infrastructure Grant Program. And so I want to say that it's very possible to make policies that are very directed to underserved communities, because that program developed a $1 million re-granting program, which went through Propel Nonprofits. And it's still here today. And so we're hoping that you will reconsider that as you work with DEED to think about the support services that they are trying to create in one of their four buckets of programming and policy. And so I wanna say that many of you around the table have already partnered with us to champion some of these very innovative models. And so I want to encourage you to continue to work with us as you develop and introduce the policies that you are working on. So I just wanna publicly thank Representative Hamilton for your leadership and in doing that with us.
Thank you, Ms. Yang, and thank you, Representative Hamilton. I see you wanna make a quick statement there.
Mr. Chairman, I was just saying thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, thank you. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just really hope that any kind of legislation that we work on is that we bring these presenters back to really help kind of craft some of it. I'm really interested with around some of Dr. Corey's ideas around the loan guarantees, and wondering if there's some creative ways that we can find some of that money to help spur some of this economic development. So This is, having him really just down the street from us is such a huge asset, and I hope we can take advantage of that as much as possible.
Thank you so much, Representative Cagle, for the insights. I know Dr. Brusker is always available to help us and guide us through this process. We appreciate the work that he continues to do. So I know for any member who's interested, he put in his contact information in the slides. Please feel free to reach out to him and ask him any questions that you may have. And for all the presenters who presented today. So thank you so much. With that, I don't see any further agenda items. So our meeting is adjourned for today. Thank you so much, members.